Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to Octopulse, our Detroit News, Detroit Red Wings podcast. I'm Mark Faulkner, Detroit News Assistant Sports Editor, joined by Ted Colfin, our Red Wings beat reporter. Coming up on the podcast, we'll hear from Hockey Hall of Famer Brian Trotche, who was Steve Yzerman's boyhood hero and the reason Yzerman wore number 19. But first, Ted, Simon Edvinson was recalled from Grand Rapids, and he'll make his NHL debut Saturday against the defending Stanley Cup champion Colorado Avalanche at Little Caesars at 1 p.m. He's one of the keys, of course, to the rebuild. A mobile defenseman, as you wrote today at DetroitNews.com. He's 6'6", 209 pounds, a first-round draft pick in 2021, and led all the defensemen with the Griffins in scoring with 27 points in 51 games. So, Ted, what can fans expect in Edvinson's debut tomorrow, and how long do you think he'll be here?
Well, I'll tell you, my friend, he's going to be easy to recognize. He's the one that looks like seven. He looks like he's 7 foot 2 inches tall on the ice. I think a lot of people are excited. I just want, you know, like to see how he fares and
sure
first NHL test here. He's a great skater. He makes a great first pass. A little bit more physical, I think, probably than a lot of people might suspect. So it'll be exciting. I think, you know, obviously this season has gone south here the last few weeks. So something like this, getting to see one of the pieces that, you know, could be a big part of the future, I think a lot of people are interested. Obviously, it should be a fun afternoon.
Let's hear now, Ted, from Coach Derek Lalonde. You asked him the other day about these final 15 games, starting with the home game Saturday against the Avalanche and Monday against the Panthers. And here's what he had to say about maintaining the team standards.
Is there a concern? When you got, 15 games left and standings are what they are. How do you, I guess motivation is not that difficult, but how do you make these games still really relevant and important for everybody?
I give the guys credit. You know, we've talked about some things that are going to keep us building forward as a group, and a lot of our core is here right now. They give the guys a ton of credit on the compete and the battle. And we had a meeting this morning, and you know, I don't want that to tail off. And basically I said, what you've shown through those Boston games, what they've shown compete-wise in Nashville, I want to hold you accountable on that, because I understand there might be a human nature to tail off of that a little bit, but we haven't hit that yet. I've actually been, you know, many things you can pick apart from our game today. Obviously, the 5 penalties, I think, were a big part of it, our inability to finish, but I was very impressed with our compete. We went and gamed it out there. We really felt we deserved better results, but it's a great question because it's something you battle with this time of year. But to date, our compete and will and want has been pretty darn good, and we would like to keep that standard.
Ted, you're right. The season has gone south on the Wings. Mathematically, they have the smallest chance of making the playoffs. Really, it's less than 1%, according to MoneyPuck.com. They have a better chance, 3% odds, of winning the lottery and selecting Connor Bedard. That lottery has a date now. It'll be on Monday, May the 8th, with non-playoff teams. They can only move up 10 spots in the lottery. The Wings also have about a 6% chance of finishing in the top two and speeding up the rebuild with perhaps a player like Michigan's Adam Fantilli. But first things first, Ted, the Wings are 9 points out of the playoffs with 15 games left. That's the mathematics. If they go 8-7, they would wind up with 85 points, 11 more points than last year. And that would be a good season, right, from Coach Derek Lalonde. He's talked about the team overachieving, but I think they would like to finish up in the 80s, mid-80s, and not perhaps fall below 500.
Now, it's going to be, I'll tell you what, at the beginning of the season, if we had I think the way we talked, if they had reached 85 points, it was probably going to be a pretty successful season. So mm-hmm. if they can get to that mid-80s, yeah, it would be a good season. I think it would definitely step forward, but I tell you, Mark, it's not going to be easy to go 8-7 the rest of the way. There's some tough teams on the schedule. This roster's been a little decimated with the trades and the injuries, so they have some work to do to get to 8-7. I'll tell you that much. If they can get into the 80s, though, obviously it would be successful, mm-hmm. especially after the year they had. It's not going to be easy, though. They have to face the Carolina twice, Tampa, Pittsburgh twice. There's some Colorado tomorrow. There's some tough teams here, and they haven't been scoring very many goals lately. Offense has been an issue with no Tyler Bertuzzi and Verana. I mean, you're definitely noticing a little bit of a difference there. They're playing well defensively. I think the team defense has really improved over the course of the season, but at least right now, scoring is, well, it's much like it has been the last couple of years. Scoring is not easy for this team.
Coming up next on the podcast, today's interview is with Hall of Famer Brian Trotche, the captain of the Islanders who won 4 straight Stanley Cups in the 1980s. Joining us now is Brian Trotche, a 7-time Stanley Cup champion with the Islanders, Penguins, and Avalanche. He's also one of Canada's most decorated Indigenous athletes, and he's the subject of a new book, All Roads Home, A Life on and Off the Ice. Brian, welcome to the podcast. Your Detroit connections go all the way back to Hall of Famer Gordie Howe. He was from Floral, Saskatchewan, just outside of Saskatoon. You're from Val Marie, quite a bit south, closer to the Montana border. In your book, you talk about going to a Gordie Howe hockey school for $80 a week, about meeting Gordie when you played for a Western Hockey League All-Star team against WHA players, and about sitting with Gordie and his wife Colleen at the NHL Awards when you won the Calder Trophy as Rookie of the Year. So, Brian, how famous and popular was Gordie in Saskatchewan, and what lessons did you learn from Detroit's 4-time Stanley Cup champion?
Well, thank you very much for the wonderful intro. I think the whole fun stuff for me mm-hmm. was realizing that Gordie Howe is just a regular person. Mm-hmm. He's bigger than life, always. He's like just the most gracious, kindest, soft-spoken human being you could ever talk. And how he just adored his wife, Colleen. He always pulled the chair out for her and put her coat on for her. It was just those kinds of things that I thought was just such a gentleman. And he was just so, and they'd get on the ice and he was like this menace. And, people would like look over their shoulders and say, watch out for Gordie this, watch out for Gordie that. You want to make Gordie mad. But he was a big man. He was at the time, as he got older, obviously we all feel like we're just, getting a little shorter or whatever. But to me, he was always a giant. I just held him in such reverence, for all of us in Saskatchewan who, grew up and watched him on TV, black and white, win or lose. He was always so, complimentary to his teammates and so proud of the NHL and hockey mm-hmm. in general. And he conducted himself and his behavior was always pristine. I revered him for so many reasons. Then you meet him in person and sure. You see all these wonderful traits he has, and I said to myself, wow, if we could all just be a little bit like Gordie, would be a great human being. And but he was just a special person on and off the ice, like my the Calder, I won Rookie of the Year, and I walked in with my family, and he was the first guy to greet us at the door, introduced us to Colleen. And my family sat down and he said, you're going to come sit with me and Colleen. And that became kind of a custom. Whenever there was like something going on, he was always the first, he would invite, and I'd sit right with him and Colleen. And all the time, my son came to Boston at another event. The Bruins were playing the Oilers in the finals. And I was given like the Man of the Year award, and for community service, and they presented a trophy, and my son got to sit with Gordy and Colleen during the event while I went up on the dais. And I said to myself, you can't write those kind of scripts, right? It's just he's one of those human beings that just really makes, I think, all of us feel special. You know, he did it to me, and you know, he taught me the right way to treat people, right way to treat ladies, and conduct yourself as I think a Saskatchewan person would, but more so how NHL people would conduct themselves. And so, you know, life lessons, but also just the quality guy. You know, I've known his family forever. It seems like we compete against Marty and Mark, obviously, and get to know Murray and the sisters. I say to myself, all the kids, and it's just been a wonderful relationship over the years. And, you know, a friendship. I go to the Hall of Fame, and he comes down and has breakfast with my mom and I the next morning. My sisters and brothers are joining us, and he's having coffee. Like, he's just as proud of me as I think anybody could be. And it's just so wonderful to have that kind of a, I don't know, just a tweak into Gordie Howe's life, and he made me feel like I was such a large part of his. So no, he's a special person in my life.
Another Detroit connection is Jimmy Devolano, who drafted you in 1974 with the Islanders. He was there in Long Island for three of your Stanley Cups and then four more cups here in Detroit. And I talked to Jimmy yesterday and asked him about that 1974 draft. He said in the first round with the fourth overall pick, the Islanders took your good friend and future line mate Clark Gillies. And in the second round, he said they took a bit of a flyer on you because of a part-time scout, Gary Kirk. And he said, quote, that Gary really, really liked you as an underage pick. And Jimmy said, boy, did we ever get lucky. But can you talk about Devolano and GM Bill Torrey and how players, Brian, really depend on management getting things right? Because here in Detroit, Jimmy drafted Bob Probert to be the next Clark Gillies. But things, of course, don't always work out. You and Clark played together for 14 years and won four straight cups. But again, can you talk a bit about how players really do depend on management to get these things right?
Well, without a doubt, I think Jimmy has played a large part in hockey, the NHL hockey world, you know, just because of his insight. Obviously, he's got a pretty good instinct towards hockey players, but you know, he was Bill Torrey's go-to guy when it comes to drafting players. I mean, he was one of those guys that was diligent. You know, he took a lot of pride in getting to games and doing his homework on hockey players and getting the fine tuning done, so to speak, and getting, you know their life as much as the player, the family and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I've gotten to know Jimmy very well over the years, and, you know, he's a quiet guy at the same time, a proud guy, but he's got wonderful history with the Islanders. He took that same experience to Detroit, and you know, to their credit, they utilized him very, very well. So you know, my hat's off to Jimmy for a whole bunch of reasons. Great friend over the years, and went to see them be, you know, and it's so nice that he said it took a flyer, but I think they did take a flyer. I was small for my size. I was, you know, 170 pounds, you know, 5'10", and I put on 15 pounds and grew an inch and a half. So go figure. You know, I, at 17, 18 years old, it is a bit of a flyer where they're taking underage guys.
Sure.
But they had to take me in the top two rounds. I'm sure they had other players that were probably more developed. But, you know, if they wait till the third round, maybe they couldn't have gotten me. They'd have to wait another year. So, yeah, they took a chance, I think, on a young kid who, you know, still had some growth in him. And I think, you know, still – but I was hungry. I wanted to make the NHL. I had a great mentor in junior, Tiger Williams, and Tiger and I were, he wanted to get the NHL. So did I. And you have a big brother like Tiger, you know, to kind of play left wing and kind of mentor you through junior hockey. And he made hockey fun for me because he was my Bob Probert in junior hockey. And all of a sudden, you know, I go to the Islanders, I got Clark Gillies. So the hockey gods are looking over me to say, hey, I'll give you a couple of protectors here, little guy. Don't take advantage of it. You better appreciate it. And I did, you know, to know that you have those type of players that are good hockey players, hungry hockey players that want to do well. And, you know, they make you feel like you're part of their life, and we're kind of pushing and pulling each other. So, it was a great time. Bill Torrey, again, Bill and Jimmy, good tandem. I mean, they both did their homework. I think for me, it was really wonderful getting to know Gary Kirk. You talk about Gary Kirk, who's a bit of a part-timer for the Islanders. You know, he was very high on me, as was Earl Ingerfield, because they were the Western Scouts at the time. And I can't thank Earl and Gary enough, because, like, I think they did their homework on me enough to sell me to Jimmy and Bill. But when Bill called me up, he goes, "Brian, we're going to fly you down and offer you a contract." And I'm like, "Holy cow, this is like spectacular. I get to meet the general manager. And it was just, it's one of those things. It's like a dream, right? And then when it happened, it happens like in a flash, like snap of a finger, boom, boom. But it's also fresh in my mind still, that first meeting when Bill offered you a contract, and it just happens so quickly. And it's just exciting. And, you know, Bill kept it exciting for us, you know, kept the core group together for a long time, and they just kept adding pieces. And, you know, you need that leadership and that vision, so to speak, from your general manager and scouts, because they're going to build your team. And, you know, if there's pieces missing, they're going to plug it in there. So, you know, to their credit, they were a great team, and we had a really good run there in the early late 70s, early 80s.
Brian, how about the connection to Steve Yzerman, who said you were his boyhood hero and the reason he wore number 19? In 1998, when Yzerman passed you for 10th in all-time scoring, he said, "As soon as he came into the league, I followed his entire career. In some ways, I tried to play like him. We all have role models, and he's mine." Yzerman also said, "I like the way he conducted himself on the ice. He was a quiet guy who played really hard, just a good all-around prototypical centerman who could do everything." So, Brian, why did you wear number 19 yourself? And what do you remember most when you competed against the Red Wings captain?
Well, it's a high compliment, obviously. A little humbling. You know, Steve's just a special person, number one. But number two, he's just an explosive, dynamic hockey player. Like, we heard about him, you know, coming into the league. And I think he was drafted the same year as LaFontaine. There was just a lot of talk about a young Yzerman and all that crop of talent that was coming into the NHL that year. And Steve didn't disappoint. I mean, he came in and he was a little terror. He wasn't big, but he was shifty, great hand, distributed the puck so well. But beyond that, he could score, and he was nifty, great little shifty little stick handler. And, you know, we were so impressed. And in those days, we didn't get a chance to go head to head a lot, but it's really kind of fun when you did. You know, to be able to, like, you know, like, not just kind of like see how he competed and how he, you know, dug in, and he was. And so we got to play a little bit against each other, and, you know, kind of compete. And it was really kind of fun. But, you know, he's given me some compliments over the years, and I thank him for it profusely. I mean, he's just a great kid all the way around. And I'm wishing him well, you know, as an executive, too. But I always say to myself, you know, when someone, you know, gives you that, you know, "Hey, he's my boyhood idol," you know, like, that's such a compliment. But I was number 19 for a bunch of different reasons. Like, I came into the league, it was the lowest number left on the team. Craig Cameron had worn that jersey the year before. He's 260 pounds and 6'3". So it was like a big giant moo-moo dress on me. So, but they rolled the sleeves up, they did a little sewing on it, and I got to wear it through most of that first year till we got the second set of jerseys in February for the playoffs, and just in case we made the playoffs, but things worked out. And it was really kind of fun. You know, like, I was 19 years old at the time. I thought, that's kind of fun. Paul Henderson was number 19. He scored the big goal for Canada at 72. Right. You know, all of a sudden I'm thinking of all the 19s, Larry Robinson, you know, Pye McKenzie and John Pronovo and Pittsburgh and every 19 that was in the league at the time. You know, I'm like Rick McLeish. It was really kind of cool to be able to, like, don that sweater and say to yourself, this is going to be my number. I'm going to make it my identity. And, you know, to kind of have the fun that's happened to me over my year, then, you know, you see other players grab a hold of it and make number 19 their own, and they have the same success. They make 19 famous, Joe Sakic, Steve Yzerman, and whoever else, Taves. And it's really kind of cool that it's become like a nice little number, kind of like number 9, you know, Gordie Howe and Maurice Richard, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, we all share a wonderful number, and it's really kind of cool when I think back and all this, these wonderful little things that happened to you. But Steve's a special, special kid. You know, he's, you know, wonderful, wonderful career. So And he, you know, he kind of like, he made his game for him at, towards the end. Like, yeah, you get 160 points and not mm-hmm. win. All of a sudden he said, you know what, I'm going to make 80, 90, 100 points and find a way to like contribute in other ways. And next thing you know, he's blocking shots, he's taking big faceoffs. And to his credit, I mean, next thing you know, they're raising the Stanley Cup over his head. And he's like me, he's got the biggest smile in the world, because that's a special moment for all of us when you can lift that cup over your head, and you know, that dream of raising a Stanley Cup over your head becomes reality. It's pretty special. So great on him. And can you continue success to Steve? Because I, you know, it's been great listening to all your wonderful, humbling comments over the years, but thank you.
Brian, Scotty Bowman was asked as well to compare the two of you, and he said you were both strong physically, both played their best in the playoffs. He said Steve had a little more acceleration, but you are probably as good a one-on-one defensive player as he's ever seen. Now, Steve played 22 years, about four more years than you, and in the regular season, he had about 300 more points than you. But in the playoffs, it was kind of interesting. Your stats are almost identical. You had 71 goals. Steve had 70. He had 185 points. You had 182 playoff points. So why were the Islanders so good in the playoffs? In the book, you talk about 1 year, a 1-4 system, forechecking, and the Red Wings were playing a 1-1-3, similar to what Derek Lalonde did in Tampa Bay, a 1-1-3 system. So why were the Islanders so good in the playoffs? And why, Brian, do some players just play better in the playoffs?
You know, that's a great question. I think a lot of us have that competitive edge. I think the adrenaline kicks in. I think you can ramp your game. If you can find another level in the playoffs, it's going to help every player. I think it helps your team. I think Steve took a lot of pride in his game. Obviously, I think when you have leadership skills within you, I think they come to the fore. I think you tend to, like Steve, a very quiet leader, but explosive. Absolutely. Like, as far as like just bearing down in the really tough situations at key moments in the game, mm-hmm. You want to be the guy that's counted on, obviously. So yeah, to compare stats is wonderful. Steve was, to his credit, I mean, he wasn't a big physical player, so like he wasn't going to bang bait people, but he was shifty. He was tough to hit. So that I think, you know, you end up having a different kind of game in that sense. But for me, you know, somebody bumped me, I was like, oh yeah, you want to play that game? Here we go. And you know, but it takes a toll over years, you know. And I say to myself, I shouldn't have probably played as physical, because I'm not a big man in that sense. I'm not 6'1", you know, 200 pounds. I was, you know, 5'11", 200 pounds. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I could take punishment. I could sting a guy once in a while. We both love to score goals. We both love to, you know, set up to our teammates. I mean, take pride and contribute offensively. But it was a kind of rely on the moment, you know, like when whatever's needed at the time, you want to be the guy on the ice the last minute of a game. You want to take the big face off. You want to be relied on. And I think, you know, I think that kind of comparison for me is a bigger compliment for Steve and myself.
Brian, thanks for your time so far on the podcast. Just a couple of more questions. Can you talk about ex-Red Wing Dave Lewis and how hard it was to see Lewis and Billy Harris traded to the Kings for Butch Goring in 1980? Lewis was here in Detroit when Yzerman was named captain. He was a veteran, and he really helped Steve behind the scenes. Eventually, he was an assistant coach and a head coach here. Back in 1980, though, your team had gone through two straight playoff losses in 78 and 79 against the Leafs and Rangers. Lewis was dealt along with Harris. Now, Harris was the first overall pick in franchise history back in 1972, and Dave was a second-round pick in 1973. Now, Jimmy Devolano, Brian, said there were other factors in winning the Cup that year. He said Gordie Lane and Ken Morrow were key additions. But just as the Wings now are dealing with the trades of Bertuzzi and Ronick and Sundquist and Verana, there can be real consequences, right, of not winning. And sometimes you lose dear friends like Dave Lewis and Billy Harris, who never got to experience those four straight Stanley Cups.
Yes, it is. It's very tough to see teammates, friends leave a team. You're building a bond. You have a, you know, you're trying to all win together. So you rely on each other and depend on each other on a daily basis. And Dave's a good Saskatchewan kid, you know, like he's from Kindersley, and you know, would you kind of share the Saskatchewan roots and those values of being a Saskatchewan kid and, you know, mm-hmm. kind of the road to the Stanley Cup? It's not easy. You know, the road to the NHL is not easy. It's, you know, it's bus trips, it's junior hockey and rough hockey even. And, you know, we shared a lot of that, you know, and then Billy Harris, godfather of my oldest son. So to see those two guys go, you got to give up something to get something. And apparently, mm-hmm. you know, that was the price that was needed in order to get a Butch Goring. And, you know, Billy Smith had history with Butch Goring, and he was pretty excited to see Butch come. Obviously, we're all a little sad to see Dave and Billy go and not have, not be able to share the glory of Stanley Cup. But it becomes part of the lore, right? That's part of the history. And, you know, to know that Dave went on to have the accomplished career he did in coaching, mm-hmm. coach the great players that he did, have some great success that way. I can't be happier for Dave and Brenda, his wife, and to be able to, like, see them today and talk about our Islander days and some of the wonderful stuff that's happened to him over the years and the fun stuff that's happened to me over the years. So, you know, still a good friend, and obviously when we bump into each other, we share family stories, and it's really kind of great to be able to, like, bump into Billy Harris too, and still buds. It's great. You know, he's kind of a little more recluse up in Northern Ontario right now, but
okay,
those friendships, they never go away, right? Those bonds, they never go away in hockey, and whether it's short period of time together, you know, everybody's got a great memory, and we kind of tease and poke fun at each other. And okay, we're a little thinner hairlines now, a little grayer along some of it. And, but the stories are pretty sharp.
Brian, in your book, you talk about one of Mike Bossy's final games here at the old Joe Louis Arena in 1987. It was March 19th, 1987. And what was notable about that game was you said Mike could hardly walk after the game. His bad back forced him out of the NHL after only 10 seasons. In that game, the Islanders won 3-2. Mike had two assists. You tied the game in the third period, and Pat LaFontaine scored the winner with 4 seconds left. What do you remember, Brian, about that game? And can you talk about how Mike Bossy paid the price, as you mentioned in the book, to go into those difficult areas to score goals and win those championships?
Well, yeah, thank you. Yeah, so Mike has, you know, obviously, greatest goal scorer ever, you know, like a purest goal scorer. He's got all these wonderful credits to his name, and well-deserved. I mean, the guy is a scoring machine. But what people didn't realize was the playmaking ability, the acceleration he had, the skating mm-hmm. ability, and the dekes and dives and that kind of stuff. So he was just underrated playmaking, you know, just underrated probably for his defensive game, underrated for competitiveness, all those things. And, you know, Mike had to go to the dirty areas, and the game in the 70s and 80s was pretty rough. You know, so you had to pay a price to go to those areas to score goals, front of the net, you know, mm-hmm. corners. And yeah, so people were taking pot shots, and obviously, so yeah, he did pay a price, and as everybody did in that era, we all did. Everybody, nobody was exempt. You know, we all had to play a part in that physical game, and whether you're doling it out or absorbing. But no, I think it took its toll on Mike. And obviously when you have the kind of pride Mike did, and when you're not playing to the level he wanted to play, he said, I don't want to play. I don't want to be just okay. I want to be great. I want to be able to contribute every game. And, you know, that towards the end, I was putting his socks and shoes on to get to the rink. You know, he couldn't bend over, and then tying his skates up in the locker room, going into the training room so he wouldn't be embarrassed. And he goes out, scores goals, you know, creates plays, and, you know, he's Mike Bossy. And then after the game, you know, he's sipping the board. We're putting ice on his back, stretching him out to get him on the plane the next day. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you're going to be fine. Away we go. Like, you're still Mike Bossy on the ice. But off the ice, he was hurting. And, you know, there's a long life after hockey. You know, you're young, you're 30, 35 years old. And, you know, he's got a lot of life left. And, we, you know, we forget about that, you know, through the course of it. We just keep, you know, I won't say brutalizing our body, but yeah, you know, pushing our bodies to the limit physically. But, you know, he's a special, special hockey player. And what he was able to do in spite of his bad back, and, you know, like you said, create a couple of assists, and, you know, Fontaine gets the winner. I mean, it's just those kinds of things, you know, are become folklore for a guy like Mike Bossy and what he was able to do. And, you know, he couldn't get his skates on in Minnesota. I think it was 2 days before, and I think or a week before that, and scores a hat trick. And I said, okay, this, you know, even though he's got a bad back and he can't walk, he'll just go on the ice and score goals. You just kind of take it for granted that he'll do it for another 10 years, you know, but not to be, you know, we lost him way too early. The NHL lost him way too early. And, you know, he wanted to be the greatest goal scorer. He didn't want to be okay. He didn't want to be, you know, kind of like, you know, just average. He wanted to be the best. He wanted to be the best, top of the league all the time, and took a lot of pride in it.
And finally, Brian, there's a Michigan hockey connection with your Indigenous background. Abby Rock has been one of our guests on the podcast, and she talked about breaking barriers and making the game more accessible to Native Americans and other minority groups. She's from the Sioux and became the first Indigenous player on the U.S. women's national team. And she's been on many tours with you and John Chabot, another former Red Wing. So, Brian, what messages are you taking to young hockey players? And have you seen the fruits of your labor making a difference in people's lives?
Well, that's a great question. It's a little hard to gauge as far as we're making a difference, but here's what we notice. And we notice that it inspires. We're trying to inspire and trying to, I don't know, influence the next generation of, we call it student athlete. Okay. Because we know not only talk about chasing a dream in the sport of hockey or whatever your desire is, your dream is, music, art, whatever it is, but you know, continue education. You know, be proud that nobody likes a dumb athlete. You know, but we always try to say to ourselves, like, if we can get that message in there, and we make hockey accessible for everyone, not just the very best of the best, but for everyone, whether it's gender, whether it's for, you know, the skinny person, whether it's for the person who feels like always a little overweight, whatever, you know, you can play hockey. It's for everybody. And that's what we hope. That's what we're trying to build. We're making it, you know, Abby's doing a wonderful job in her messaging. Mm-hmm. She's a wonderful ambassador for hockey in general, but for gals hockey, for Indigenous young hockey players. I think it's just a good message. You know, diversity is a wonderful thing, you know, like, there's a lot of diversity in the NHL and in hockey in general. You know, doesn't matter what your background is, you know, Scottish, Irish, you know, Russian, you know, Canadian, you know, Indigenous, you know, it doesn't matter where you come from. If you got a love of the game and you can come, go on the ice and be a big part of it and enjoy the game, that's what we're trying to do. And you want to try to push it to the highest level you can. And if you have a dream of playing in the Olympics or you have a dream of playing in the NHL and raising the Stanley Cup over your head, right on. Take it as far as you can and use it as your you know, your motivation to get an education or, mm-hmm. or, you know, experiences in life and life skills, and hockey's good that way. So, yeah, we're proud of our Indigenous athletes that are playing in the NHL and all the young kids that are playing currently, and we think there's another generation right behind them. And females, boys, I think it's going to be awesome. So, you know, keep your eyes open and hang on, because I think there's another crop coming along.
Brian, thanks again today for joining us on the podcast and talking about Gordie Howe, Clark Gillies, Mike Bossy, Steve Yzerman, of course, Scotty Bowman, Dave Lewis, and your Native heritage. Once again, the book is called All Roads Home, A Life On and Off the Ice with former Globe and Mail reporter Stephen Brunt. All the best, Brian, from Ted Colfin and I here in Detroit.
Pleasure, guys. Thank you so much. A real, really wonderful, wonderful podcast. Thank you.
Our thanks again to Brian Trotche and those kind words at the end. Now let's hear from Steve Yzerman from his news conference 2 weeks ago on Friday, trade deadline day. He was asked about trading Jacob Verana to the Blues for a 7th-round pick in 2025 and forward Dylan McLaughlin. Here was his response, wishing Verana all the best in St. Louis.
Well, I don't think I can really go into details on a lot of the things that have gone on. I would just say I wish Jacob the best of luck in his hockey career and on and off the ice. It was just time for both parties to move on.
Ted, Jacob Verana will make his first appearance against the Red Wings next week. Detroit will be in St. Louis next Tuesday and then back here on Thursday at Little Caesars Arena. He has 4 goals in 5 games with the Blues, 3 of them on the power play. But after all that happened, and we've documented that here on the podcast, the shoulder injury, the NHL, NHLPA player assistance program, being put on waivers, benched in the minors, all those things, Ted. There was really no way, was there, that he was going to play another shift for this Steve Yzerman, Derek Lalonde team?
Well, he did come back here, but yeah, I mean, what? He was healthy, scratched several games. Really didn't do too much in the games he did play, but boy, I mean, yeah, he's had a nice start in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
The kid is a goal scorer. There's no question about it. He knows how to score goals. A couple of those goals that he scored in St. Louis were just, you know, they were nifty little goals. They really were. Ironically, I think tonight, isn't he in Washington, Mark? I think
he's
playing the Capitals again tonight. And then we were joking around the other day in the office. It's like, I wonder if they're going to – there's no way they'll do a video tribute for him here next Thursday, will there? I doubt it. Yeah. Just hope for the best for him. He's a good guy.
Yes.
Hope on and off the ice things do – work out well for him. And yeah, obviously on the ice right now in St. Louis, he's — that team needs scoring, and well, this team needed scoring or needs scoring. And when he's at his best, he knows how to put the puck in the net. There's no question.
Finally, let's hear from Adam Ernie. He leads all Detroit forwards in hits with 141 and blocked shots with 45. He has 8 goals and 8 assists in 50 games. Here he is talking about returning to the team after clearing waivers and playing in Grand Rapids for about a month.
A lot more ice time down there, a lot more touches of the puck. But like I said, I thought I was playing well before. I think it was just a matter of, you know, when I was going to come back up and just making sure I played well and worked on my game down there.
Ted, what do you make of those two stats, hits and blocked shots, subjective numbers in some rinks? We've talked about that. Absolutely. The Wings are ranked 6th in blocked shots, and there have been injuries, right? 2 broken hands for Bertuzzi, Zadina's broken leg, Rasmussen's knee injury. Seider and Sherratt are ranked 1-2 in blocked shots. Not all good teams block shots. Vegas is number 1 with one of the biggest blue lines in the league, but the Flyers, Canadiens, and Blue Jackets are next in line. The Flyers came into here and blocked 31 shots to beat the Wings 2-1. It usually means you don't have the puck. And same thing with hits, right? The Wings are ranked 20th in hits, more than last year. But top teams like the Avalanche, Devils, Maple Leafs, and Hurricanes are near the bottom. But combined, those are effort plays. And I just wondered what your thoughts are about the team's big improvement in those two categories and how Ernie sometimes does supply some of that heavy hockey.
No, you're right. I mean, they are subjective. That's the thing. It's tough to really put too much credence in those because some rinks, they dish them out like candy. I mean, and then other rinks, the stats crew really goes out of their way not to put them on. So, but it's the eye test, obviously, Mark. It's the eye test. And Ernie's one of those guys that will, you know, he's that type of player. Interestingly, though, you wonder, will he be brought back next season? I kind of doubt it. And I'll tell you one thing, we haven't brought him up here in this show, but what a start for Alex Chiasson. I mean, he's
played really well here.
I can definitely see Alex Chiasson being brought back next year. I mean, he does a lot of the little things. Has he been a revelation on the power play in a small sample size. He's done a really good job. And he can kind of play that type of game. Maybe not quite the Adam Ernie type of grit game, but he can kind of play that game. So Ernie will get a job somewhere in the NHL. I don't think there's any question. He plays hard. He's willing to give up his body that way. And I like the stat, but just, you know, take it with a grain of salt.
Absolutely. And that'll do it for episode 87 of our Detroit News, Detroit Red Wings podcast. Again, thanks for your time today, Ted. And you can find all of Ted's stories online at DetroitNews.com as well as on our Octopulse Facebook page. Thanks again, everyone, for listening, rating, and reviewing these podcasts.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.